Welcome inside the Legends Lounge, where baseball VIPs are hanging out and talking about their life in the game.
Oh, this one was a good learning experience for me. We're hitting your home state. We're in Lee County, Fort Myers area, where Mike Greenwell is a big deal in the community. And it's something I didn't realize. He's a super busy guy coming off a very great MLB career. And he's all over the place in a good way.
Great MLB career. I mean, this is a guy that really not only represented on the field, but off the field. I'm looking forward to talking to him. And you're right. I mean, what's kind of weird and cool is that he's a Lehigh County there guy, a Fort Myers guy, ends up being that, the Red Sox, his team of about 14 years, comes over to Fort Myers. So it's kind of befitting. And he's gone on to do so many cool things outside of baseball that I'm looking forward to hearing the in and outs of Mike Greenwell.
Yeah, and also dealing with devastation in his community.
Correct.
And how he's a part of fixing that every single day. It's made his job significantly more hectic. So here's Mike Greenwell. Twelve-year big leaguer, two-time All-Star, coming through the lounge, a career 303 hitter, all 12 seasons with the Boston Red Sox, and he's been a busy man ever since his playing days concluded. Mike Greenwell in the lounge. Mike, great to connect with you. How's life? I know it's very busy.
It has been busy. I was appointed county commissioner here in Lee County by Governor DeSantis in September, so... and right afterwards, of course, we had that big hurricane. So kind of learning on the run here. But we had a pretty big disaster and one of five commissioners here and making a lot of pretty important decisions.
I tell you what, you kind of know Fort Myers very, very well. This isn't like you just, moved over there a few years ago. You came over there as a youngster from Kentucky, where you were born in Louisville. And I know you love that area and you love its people. So now as a kind of a representative of the people, how are you guys doing post this incredible, devastating Hurricane Ian?
Well, we're doing well, actually. We've got a great governor and he's done a great job really kind of pulling everything together. And never met a politician that when he made a promise, he kept it. And he's kept every one of them. It's been amazing, really. And I think there's a lot of other states that should be pretty jealous. We're very fortunate to have the Governor DeSantis as our governor, for sure.
Hear, hear.
So what have you had to go through over the last several months, of course, since the hurricane?
Well, I think the biggest thing is really just seeing all the devastation and seeing so many people's lives just torn apart. We tend to be people that, we kind of forget pretty quick. But when you see the amount of devastation we had on the coast, and we have a large coast. So
yes.
Even up our river, because we are on the Coosatchee River. I live 20 miles from the Gulf of Mexico off the river. And we had flooding all the way up here. It's just amazing that we have over 50,000 homes that are flooded. So the devastation's been pretty bad. We have about 25,000 homes that have been almost totally, either just totally destroyed or over 50% destroyed.
And this is all just in Lee County?
All in Lee County. Yeah. We have 850,000 people here. So we're a large county. And you could tell because we're able to have two major league baseball teams have spring training here. So we're, we're obviously a big area.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, because of the power of this and how it affected Lee County, Lehigh area, all around there, Fort Myers. Like, I'm assuming that both the Twins and the Boston Red Sox, were hands-on for you guys and at the city commission offices and anything that you guys needed from them.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great relationship. Very fortunate to have been a Red Sox player and be able to represent our county here as well. But now the Red Sox have always been great. The Twins are great. Very involved in the community. And we're about ready to get started with spring training. And fortunately, we're ready to go for them. We know they're obviously a priority. It's a big part of our community. It's a big part of what brings money to this area. So we're ready for them. Come on.
What's the connection there for you landing in that location? Does any of it have to do with the Red Sox? Like, did you end up in that area because of it, or just random?
No, actually, I brought the Red Sox here. So I'm going to take all the credit. I'm going to take all
it was the
credit.
It was the Royals back then.
That's right. Yeah. Old timers, right?
Come on now.
Well, I'll tell a quick little story. When I was in high school, we didn't have a lights at our high school stadium. So we played at Terry Park. So I would go climb up in a tree in the outfield in left field, ironically. And I would wait for George Brett to come out of the game because he was like my idol. And he would be running along the fence, you know, getting a little extra running in. It was one of his things that he did every game after every game when they pulled him out early. And I would always talk to him. And fate has some funny things that happen, you know. In my first at bat against the Kansas City Royals, when George Brett was playing third base, I hit a triple. And I pinch hit, and I'm standing on third base. And of course, they're changing pitchers, and George walks up to me, taps me on the leg, goes, "Good job, kid." I said, "Mr. Brett, you remember me?" And he said, "No." And I said, "I'm that kid in the red and black uniform in the tree." And he's like, "Are you kidding me?" I'm like, "No."
Wow.
He said, "I'm not that old, man. I'm not that old." And he walked away from me. But he was that old.
Wow.
And you were that good.
I appreciate it. But it was funny because we always had a relationship after
great
that.
Great story.
I couldn't believe that I was that kid that bugged the hell out of him in spring training.
My God. Listen, it is so cool because, you know, and I wanted to touch on your younger years, but I'm going to jump right into it, Brett, because obviously you were impacted by the Fort Myers being the home of the Kansas City Royals, right? They also, I remember coming up through the ranks with the Yankees, Mikey and you know, facing the Fort Myers Royals, Brett Saberhagen. I mean, it was ridiculous, the pitchers they had back then in A-ball as I worked my way up to the big leagues. But for you, here's George Brett. Here's this young left-handed hitter. Here's Charlie Lau. Here's Walt Riniak. And you end up being with the Boston Red Sox. And A, you technically bring the Red Sox over to Fort Myers, which is great, your hometown. But your swing was very much similar to that same George Brett, Charlie Lau, Walt Riniak school of hitting. How cool was that? And then did you mimic that because of Brett?
Absolutely. I used to go home. I would watch the game. And, of course, you know, we didn't have TV. Spring training games weren't on TV. But I would go watch. And I would go get in front of the mirror and pretend, you know, take his swing. And I always released my top hand because he did. And so I really, really emulated him. And that's probably one of the reasons I had the success I had. But and then, of course, having Walt Riniak, who was very big about Charlie Lau's style of hitting and way of hitting. And it was funny, me and him actually butted heads because I would tell him, "You're going too far. Charlie Lau didn't do that. And I'm not going that." And I would argue with him about it, and I wouldn't do that. You know, I wouldn't get over the baseball because Charlie Lau didn't teach get over the baseball. He caught, you know, extension and getting, you know, hitting behind the baseball. So we disagreed a little bit about that, but I never let him change me. I always stuck to my guns.
I want to follow up on that because it was interesting. And I was telling Scotty B before you came on, the example of that is one Rich Gedman, who took it to the other extreme. Explain to Scotty B Rich Gedman's swing, which he would just go overboard with it.
Yeah. What happens is Walt started kind of taking that next step where he started teaching guys to kind of get over the baseball and almost, you know, kind of almost head down instead of head out, you know. And loved Walt to death, but he hurt some players, in my opinion, because it took away their power. You know, the downswing, all that did definitely generate backspin.
Releasing the top hand, that was all good. you know, but then getting all, yeah, that was the difference. And you stayed true
over the baseball. They would actually get over the baseball. And
right.
It looked, I saw myself do it in the 86 World Series. I came home and watched the highlights and I'm like, oh my God,
that was, what's going on? Or,
I'm excuse me, 85 World Series. And I realized, let me say, so I
no,
realized
86. It was 86. Yeah. You're just with the Mets.
Yeah. With the Mets. And I realized, I don't want to look like that. It was taking it too far. And to go one step further, when I, the first time I took swings in spring training in Winter Haven, Florida, just so happened there was this guy standing there, and I think his name was Ted Williams. And, yeah, right. And he literally called, and you know, if you've ever met Ted, this is the way he talked. Hey, kid, come here. So I went over, and he said, don't let nobody F with that swing ever. Yes, sir. Wow. So I just never forgot that. So when me and Walt was kind of butting heads pretty bad in the in spring training in 87, he literally gets mad and throws the balls and tell me get out of his cage because I wouldn't change. I just wouldn't change. And so ironically, we play the first spring training game. And, you know, again, life brings you some funny things. As I walk up to the dugout after I loosen up in the outfield, getting ready to start the game. And who's sitting in the dugout? Ted Williams. And he said, hey, kid, remember I told you don't let nobody F with that swing? And I said, yes, sir. And he goes, I meant it. He was sending a message to Walt Reniac to leave me alone and work with what we had. So the next day, Walt apologized, and we had a great relationship with that thing from that
point
on.
Oh, my God.
But I will tell you what Walt did that was special, and this is what made him so good that people didn't realize. Walt played with your mind. And a quick little example was he said to me one time, Frank Bowell, we're playing the Twins. Frank Bowell is pitching. He walks up, sits down next to me in the dugout right before the game. And he goes, hey, kid, what's Bowell out there thinking? I said, well, I don't know what he's thinking. He goes, I can tell you what he's thinking. He's hoping he can just contain you because you're too damn good. He can't stop you. And he got up and walked away. And I thought to myself, I'm way too good. He can't stop me. I went 3-for-4 off of him with a 3-run homer. Walt told me after the game I was 0-for-14 until then.
No.
So playing that time, you know,
yeah,
it worked.
That's awesome. Yeah. So, that's psychology 101.
Yeah. So
old school.
You can use mentality a little bit with that thought process. Walt was great at it. Absolutely.
Wow. That is wild. All right. We're going to have you fly kind of all over the career span here. So first off, let's go back to Fort Myers days and you're playing ball. And you get a call from the University of Miami to play football, yet you didn't play football at all. Like you never put on a helmet and did anything.
No, I played high school football.
Oh, you did play high school football.
Yes.
Oh, not your senior year, I should say. Right?
Yeah.
Is that what it was?
Senior
year. Because I was, I kind of, even though we didn't have ESPN and we couldn't follow it like they can today, but I kind of knew I felt I was going to get drafted and I thought I was going to get drafted relatively high. And I just, even though I was the starting quarterback on the football team at North Fort Myers High School my junior year, I decided it wasn't worth it. I'm just not going to play and decided not to. And it was the right decision for me. And ironically, you know, my son, who ended up getting drafted by the Indians, or I should say the Guardians now, he actually played his senior year and tore his ACL. So, and he actually had signed to go to the University of Miami as well. So maybe I should have made him make the same decision I made.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Howard Schellenberger is still pissed at you, so as far as I know.
Yeah.
The head coach at UM.
Coach. Yeah. Fraser's baseball coach was too.
Fraser was a very dear friend of mine, man. Rest in peace, man. And what a great man. Schellenberger, I never got to meet, but I'm you know, I'm from Miami, Mikey. And that was a dynasty era of college football back then.
Yeah, and the baseball.
And baseball, too. I mean, they were winning championships left and right. Ron Fraser was a legend. And speaking of that, so then you sign, and here comes your beginning stages of your pro career, and you ascend pretty darn quick. I mean, you just had that beautiful swing. And talk a little bit about the ascension and the awe of getting to Fenway, man. That had to be something special.
It was, because it was crazy. I literally, 2.5 years after signing out of high school, so, you know, 21 years old, I'm in the major leagues. I mean, it went fast. And ironically, I played the Penn League. Then I played the Carolina League, but I was leading the league in hitting in July, and I tore my a ligament in my knee and needed surgery. So I missed the rest of the season. They sent me back to the Carolina League, which I was very disappointed in, but I had a great year from top to bottom. The RBIs, the home runs, the extra base hits, the batting average, everything. So I got put on the 40-man roster, and I get to spring training. And they tell me in spring training I'm moving from third base to the outfield, and I couldn't figure out why, just because we had this guy named Hogs. It was pretty bad. So we had some older guys in the outfield, Rice and Evans. You know, we're getting up into the years. You know, 12 years at that point in the major leagues. So it made sense. I moved to the outfield, but I had an unbelievable spring training. I hit .406 in spring training with 7 home runs.
Wait a second. That's Ted Williams type numbers.
Yes. Yes.
So you never thought about that.
Yeah. So I come from A-ball to do, and the reason I did so well is Rice got hurt, and it allowed me to play a lot. So I got to start a lot of games, which a rookie kid out of A-ball doesn't get to do that, but I was fortunate and did, because they were trying to find out if I could play the outfield. So I was the last guy to get sent down, and I was obviously disappointed, even though it wouldn't make sense to take a kid from A-ball to the big leagues. But they said they told me their excuse was that I'm going to be a kid that plays every day, so they don't want to have me sitting on a bench, go down and play every day. So I got to skip double A, and they put me in triple A. And by that July, I was in the major leagues. So I was pretty lucky.
That's incredible. So, and then you get up to the bigs, and was the adjustment period for you, forget the stats and all of that, the adjustment period for you just getting acclimated to being with the Sox and that big league life, was that difficult for you? Did that come easy? Was it fun? Cause obviously the perks are better in the bigs, right?
Oh yeah. And I'm going to tell you, boy, after just 3 hits in the major leagues, my career really started to go downhill because my first 3 hits were home runs.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I did not know that either. That's not in the notes, though.
Yeah.
No.
I think one other person's done that ever in the history of the game. But yeah, my first 3 hits in the major leagues were home runs. And
this shit was easy for you. You were like, I own this league.
Yeah. So, it's kind of hard to top that, you know what I mean? But, I was very fortunate. I actually pinch hit. I'll never forget the first home run and first hit in the major leagues. We were playing in Toronto, and they pinch hit me in the 8th inning. Buckner led off with a double. He was on second, and they brought me in to pinch hit, but they brought a lefty in. And when the lefty came in, McNamara called me back to the dugout. And I guess the look on my face was disappointment, obviously. And he looks at me, he goes, "You know this guy?" I said, "Yes, sir. I faced him this year in AAA." He said, "Can you hit him?" I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Then go hit him." You know, Mac was that old time, yes, you know, kind of coach, you know. Yeah. Yeah. And so I went up there and I hit a 2-run homer to win the game. And from that point on, Mac believed in me, I guess, right? So just fortunate. I actually, all joking aside, I really started on fire. I hit 385. I hit 386. I hit 387 in 88. So I just took off. I just was very fortunate.
88 was a monster year, bro. I remember that distinctly for you. I mean, not that you hadn't already come out, but you know, at that point in time until 88, I think it was more considered like, wow, this guy's a sweet swinger. You know, it'd be nice to see him kind of put it all together, you know. And yeah, dude, yeah, you put it all together. If it wasn't for Jose's 40-40 that year, you were just owning the league, you know, hits, doubles, RBIs, and average. You just felt comfortable. And Scotty, I'll tell you, his swing, you know, they say like, hey, a swing was made for Fenway. Yes, it was made for Fenway. There's a lot of inside, but he could pull too. I mean, it was a dramatic gap to gap type swing that was very, very impressive. You know, it was impressive to me, buddy. 88. How do you remember 88?
Just one of those years where I just couldn't do no wrong. I mean, I really had a good 87 and really became that everyday player in 87. But I missed almost the first month of the season. So just because they weren't playing me. And unfortunately, when I got in the lineup, because of Rice's injury. When he came back, I never came out of the lineup from that point on. So, so I had a good 87, but boy, 88, I kind of really understood what pitchers were trying to do to me. You know, when I first fastball, you throw a fastball, I'm going to hit it. And by 88, I realized that if you're going to start me off with something soft, I'm going to sit on it. And I just kind of had an exploding year, and the pitchers really never figured out that I had went from a fastball type hitter to sitting on off speed stuff. And they were just picking it up to me. So had a great year. Just great year.
Nowadays, you know, next AB, they would have been like, hey, he's on the soft stuff.
Yeah. You know, even though we did that, I just don't think it dawned on a lot of guys, because I had such an early reputation of being that first pitch fastball hitter. And they just wouldn't throw me that first pitch fastball. So they were starting me off with changeups and fork balls and sliders, and I was sitting on them.
You had a great approach, a great game plan, obviously outthinking guys at times. And I'm wondering how much thought was going into at the time for you. Hey, when this ends, what do I want to do? What am I doing? Right. And I mean, this is a big part of what we talk about here with players. You, as you talked about at the beginning, have a very busy life and a very important job. You've also done a number of other things. And I'll just drop a few and you can add to the resume if you'd like to enlighten everyone. But you were driving late model stock cars. You were in, the Speed Weeks Track Championship, Craftsman Truck Series. So you were driving. You had an amusement park in Cape Coral. So anything else? Am I missing some major?
Well, I've had an amazing life, and I've just always been a person that goes after goals. And after baseball, obviously I had built an amusement park when I was 26 years old, here in Cape Coral, Florida, that we kept for 28 years. But I actually, one of my dreams was to race in NASCAR, and fortunately I was able to race in NASCAR, and more or less not to do it as a job. I just wanted to prove that I could do it. And was able to do that. And then, of course, then we started a company called Big League Builders, and we have a general contracting company here in town, which unfortunately, when I became a county commissioner, and our company does some different government work. So I had to let my children buy me out because
get out of here, Dad. Get out of here. We'll take care of it. You're the Donald Trump. You're the Donald Trump of Lee County, I guess, is basically. Yeah. Yeah. You had to get by minus certain billions, but you had to get bought out by the kids.
Yeah, I'm so excited, and I'm literally about to start it February the 1st through the 3rd. I did a lot of bass fishing. Obviously, growing up here, Lake Okeechobee and in Florida. And as of even though I'm a county commissioner, it just works out perfect. I'm actually going to fish 10 MLF Major League Fishing tournaments starting in February. And they're all over. Going to Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia, Florida, South Carolina. And possibly doing some in North Carolina and maybe in Missouri. So, but I've got 10 lined up for this year. So I'm going to try to be a pro bass angler too. Why not?
Nice. Add it up to me. But listen, that's all great. The bass fishing, the bat a ball family fun park, driving trucks, Lee Howe County Commissioner. That's all good and dandy. What I want to know, the freaking gator grabbing and wrestling and tying down a gator. Talk to me about that, Mike, because this is wild, and I can't believe you used to do that stuff.
Yeah, you know, growing up here, it was just, I don't know, it was just, we had a lot of water in the area I was in. And
so what? I don't care. Don't you, know, you make it sound like, oh, we had so many gators. We live by they Alligator do. Alley. I mean... Yeah.
We did it, and it was. I would just, as a kid, if we saw a little 3-footer going across the canal or somewhere, we would try to catch it, and we did. But I got to tell you the story of how the gator happened, why people started calling me that. Ellis Burke's one of my dearest friends.
Oh, good guy, good guy.
Yeah. He was scared of everything that crawled. So I pull in spring training in Winter Haven, Florida one morning, and I happen to notice, you know, chain of lakes. So there's a lake right behind the ballpark. And I noticed this gator that's sticking his head out under at this covert pipe. So I thought, boy, the next morning I'm going to go catch this thing. So I crawled up on the ground and got up over the covert pipe, and he stuck his head out. When he did, I reached down, I grabbed him by the mouth and his neck, and I jerked him out of the water. Now, he was a little bit bigger than I thought he was. I thought he was 3 foot, but he was actually about a little over 4 feet. So he was a handful. Well, I didn't know some guys had drove up, you know, because I got there really, really early. But a couple guys had drove up, and they saw me crawling. So they were trying to figure out what the hell I was doing. So they witnessed me catching that alligator by hand. Uh-huh.
So I heard this story.
Yeah, so I actually put it in. I taped its mouth up. I put it in Ellis Burke's locker. I stuck his travel bag over it. And everybody in the clubhouse is aware that there's an alligator sitting in there. And, of course, Ellis is notorious for being the last guy there. He shows up rushing, goes over, grabs his bag, pulls it up. You couldn't have done it any better. This gator spins around, and Ellis, you know, of course, looks down, and this alligator's, like, lunging at him. So it was the funniest thing I've ever seen. If I had it on video, I would
– oh, my gosh.
I would make millions. It would be so worth it.
That would be viral. That would be so viral.
Yeah, of course, the media, someone said it, told the media, and I denied it. I'm like, I didn't catch an alligator. Talking about. So, I denied it. And but I get to Fenway Park, and I guess even though I denied it, they wrote the article about, oh, some players saw him do it by hand. And so I get to spring training, and first thing I hear coming out of the dugout, gator! I never heard of it again, ever, ever. It was gator after that. So that's how it happened.
Gator Greenwell.
Yeah, that's
how it happened. See, some people are like, oh, how'd you get that nickname? That's a story on how
that's a great story.
That's a legitimate story.
And Ellis still probably squares you out from doing that
We used to have a great time, so I've been fortunate, man. I've done a lot of neat things, and my wife says all the time, you really need to start writing this stuff down and write a book. How many people say, you know, you've been in NASCAR now. You know, my goal, I'm going to win one of these tournaments. I'm going to win one of these major league
tournaments. The best that you're into that, huh? You go win this. There's some big money in some of those, buddy.
Yeah. If you win one, it's anywhere from $70,000 to $95,000.
Yeah, buddy.
Wow.
Yeah.
If I win
I'll caddy you for that, man. I'll have the bucket for the fish and stuff, you know. You know, I'll be the big Cuban. I know about fishing now and the waters. I mean, you know, I had to swim over here from Cuba, but I don't like no gators, man. The Cubans don't like, I drive fast through Alligator Alley, buddy. I'm not stopping and trying to tape an alligator's mouth. Are you out of your mind?
Well, there are definitely witnesses out
That's
there.
Awesome, that That's awesome, though.
That I actually caught it by hand.
Oh, I want to be his agent between fishing. Dude, and
he's doing some great stuff.
Hook him up with a publishing deal.
This is a show waiting to happen. It's almost like some zany, you know, former, you know, a great athlete that's doing all this, you know, all this crazy stuff now. You know, what next can he do? Can he sky jump?
My sons were on this because when I was 14 years old, to stay in shape, I boxed. And we went over to Daytona, and there was the main event that night was the Golden Glove lightweight champion. He was 22 years old. I was just on the card fighting, you know, another kid, 14 or 15 years old. Well, the guy that was supposed to fight the Golden Glove lightweight champion that night got in a car accident on the way there. He wasn't injured, but they wouldn't let him fight. So they convinced me to fight the Golden Glove lightweight champion. And that was going to be the main fight that night. And I actually knocked him out.
No way, dude. At 14. Yeah,
at 14. So I can't even imagine today that they would allow a 14-year-old to fight a 22-year-old. But back then, you know, we were pretty all crazy, I guess. But yeah,
not legally they wouldn't. No,
there's no way.
That would have to be some illegal
deal.
That's
an official match these days.
Right. So because I knocked him out, you know, then I wanted to do it more. My parents he actually beat me up pretty good, but I just got that punch in and knocked him out. So I had two black eyes, and I was embarrassed to go to school until they announced that I had knocked out the Gold Glove lightweight champion. Then I couldn't get in a fight because everybody was scared of me. But I tell that story because my kids, when Jose Canseco started doing these fighting, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One was trying to set up a deal where I would fight Jose Canseco for the MVP.
Right. So, for real, because the 88 one that he stole from you.
Yeah.
That was the 40-40.
Well, the bad thing was my son, it was kind of working with their people back and forth. But then Jose kind of took that dive with an injury to his shoulder and got like $1 million. And
yeah. So yeah.
Ruined the whole thing. But I was going to fight him because I thought, man, you want to talk about something cool.
That would have been.
Had that MVP trophy sitting there and he was saying, you know, he admits he was using steroids. I wasn't. So now I'm going to come get my trophy. But
you know what? The problem is that Jose might have sent Ozzy instead of Jose as his twin brother.
You're right. Well, you're right. That's a good
Jose, we went to high school together. Yeah. He's a couple years younger than me. But so after he started making it big, there was sometimes notoriously where he couldn't make a signing. And he would send his twin brother to the signing, to the autograph signing. And it would show up in front instead of him. Because, I'm Jose.
Yeah. You know, I loved Jose. I was fortunate to get to
play
with
Shaky
him.
Was the best. He is the best.
Yeah, good guy. Yeah. Good guy.
Oh, my God. I love him. Yeah. And Ozzy. Ozzy is the salt of the earth.
Yeah, good guy.
Yeah, buddy. Yeah. You gave us a Gator story is almost as good as any No Way Jose story I can think of. But you got one more. Zany story to kind of leave us with that you can think of from back in the day on and off the field.
Oh, well, gosh, let's see. Probably one of the crazier times I think being a Red Sox player is I think realizing I guess the best story I could tell about that is it was such a great honor to be a Red Sox player and you're never forgotten. They it's like being a Yankee, forget you. And you're part of that forever. But I never will forget. I did some crazy stuff back then and I just signed a 4-year contract and I get invited to a racetrack at Seekonk Speedway in Rhode Island, which is 40 miles from Boston, to do a little autograph session. But they also offered me an opportunity to get in a race car and drive it around the track. So of course I did. And I had signed a 4-year contract at that point. And the press gets a hold of it. They make a big deal about how I violated my contract and that the Red Sox could release me if they wanted because I violated my contract. It says right in my contract, I can't race cars. So Lou Gorman came out, our general manager, and really didn't back me. So I decided that next day the article came out about it and they were kind of blowing me up, booing me. I was hitting like 318 and they were booing me.
Who cares that you drove around the track?
Yeah. Yeah. So I was at the plate that day and they were booing me when they announced me and Carlton Fisk was catching and he yells out time, and he's a big fella and he jumps up and he scared the heck out of me. And he like got right in my face and he said, kid, you're hitting 318. Get the hell out of this town. In other words, they're booing you. Are you kidding me? So, but I decided that next day I went up to the press box or up to the stairs and I asked for Lou Gorman's office. I went in Lou Gorman's office. He's sitting there smoking a cigar. And I said, Lou, I want to come and apologize for breaking my contract. And I would like you to go ahead and release me. Because I'm hitting 318.
No, you didn't.
Wow. I thought it's like 2 months into the season. I'm hitting 318. I'm on the second year of my, or first year of my, this 4-year deal. But right. I've now realized that I probably could make a lot more money if they just go ahead. So I'll never forget as long as I live.
Tear up this deal.
He takes the puff of the cigar and he leans back and he goes, so kid, what are you trying to do? Get me fired? He said, nobody releases a 300 hitter. And I said, you know what, Lou, you're right. I think you should have a press conference and back me about that race car thing, don't you? And he said, we'll have that today. And boy, he had a big press conference saying they looked
at my God. I like my
contract and it was all good.
Wow. How about that?
That's some good leverage right there. You just bring that batting average with you, bring it, just have them nicely on your shoulder right there.
Yeah. I do have to tell y'all something that I'm so proud of. When I signed, remember now, we didn't have ESPN. We didn't know. And I was just a little kid from Fort Myers that signed a contract. But I found out later on that guys that were picked, you know, 30, 40, 50 players behind me got more money than me. So I always took that to heart. And my dad said to me one time, you know, if you don't know how to handle your money, you don't deserve it. So I decided to really start researching. And I became, even though I had an agent that took care of my off-the-field stuff, I negotiated every contract I ever had. So I'm very proud of that.
You did.
It became very tough. Yes, every contract. So I never ended up, I never filed for free agency. I never went to arbitration. And I negotiated every one of my own contracts. And at one point, I was the highest Red Sox player in history for 2 weeks until they signed this guy named Clemens.
Yeah, well, geez, he was pretty good. Pretty good.
Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah, but
story.
He had to pay a, you know, he had to pay a cut to his agent. You saved that whatever percent. Yeah,
I tell you what, no, I'm still impressed on the Gorman story. That was ballsy right there, buddy. That was outstanding. Good call. I'm all for you. You're damn right. You should do that. There's Carlton Fisk, probably playing for the White Sox at the time, right? He had yeah, left. Who was the? I mean, you couldn't get more iconic in the 70s than Kyle Carlton Fisk, who's realized this town's a tough town, man. I mean,
and that's what clicked in my head when he told me that the day before, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to go upstairs and tell him that I think they should release me. Lou Gorman reminded me of that story about 50 times over the years. Up in my
That's
office, trying to get me fired. That's what he would tell
me. You trying to get me fired, son?
That's what he
hey,
did.
That's good leverage right there. You were your best agent. You represented yourself,
Scotty.
Super
you know
well.
What you learned, and I learned it too, man. If you rake, you eat cake, man, because it doesn't matter. I'm telling you, they forget everything and they forgive everything in the end, especially the organizations. I mean, some fandom might be a little particular, but even the fandom, right, Mikey? I mean, in the end, if you produce, you know, you get supported and you produce, man. You had a great career, buddy. And keep doing some great things over there at Lee County, man. I love that area down there. We've got some good friends over in Bonita Springs and all the way down to Marco Island. And it's a lovely area that got, you know, devastated. So we'll keep you in our prayers as you continue to develop.
We know you're going to build it back better than ever, Gator. We really do. So we're there for you.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to spring training this year when the Red Sox come.
I'll pop down there and check up on you, man.
Put that leverage back again. So,
yeah. Yeah. If I'm around you, I'm going to be looking around my back for some Gators, man. I don't. I'm like Ellis. I'm not good about the creepy crawlies, brother.
Yeah. Well, let's do this again sometimes, guys.
You know it, man.
Oh, your career, and I mean this not just in baseball, but in many careers, often comes down to leverage. And Mike Greenwell had that with his batting average. Just throw that on some paper, push it across the table and say, yeah, I'm good.
No doubt. And I mean, with that last story there about, you know, him getting not ridiculed, but booed. I mean, no doubt. You know, we know how strong the Boston you know, nation is, Phillies, you know, there's a handful of cities in the baseball world that just, they protect their commodity of their hometown team. And they're thinking, well, if you want to take your life in your own hands, that means we're going to lose a key outfielder, then get the heck out of here. But hold on a second, Scotty B. He was hitting 318. I don't know if you want to. They finally decided, no, I don't think we're going to do that. So what a cool story. Again, on and off the field, as far as all the things that he's done with his life. What a great athlete. What a great hitter he was. I mean, he was in my era of the 80s and 90s. And I just think that, you know, he represented so well. And then to think of what he's done in his own community, especially, you know, around Hurricane Ian and helping restore that area. Really big fan of Mike Greenwell, brother.
Me too. Great, great guy. Really nice guy to speak to and had some good stories to share. This will be maybe my worst transition ever, but putting the green in Greenwell right now with St. Patty's Day coming up. I had to go there. I mean,
that was not
why
bad.
Do you have Mike Greenwell this week? Well, you know, you asked. Hey. This week in baseball, March 17th.
Greenwell?
Yes, they did wear Greenwell. March 17th, 1978, the Reds wore special green unis to commemorate St. Patrick's Day. St. Patrick's Day coming up on Friday. The Reds never used those uniforms in regular season play, of course, if we're going back years ago. March 17th, it's spring training action. So it did work.
Exactly.
They won the game 9-2. No one cares because it's
right.
Spring training.
It's a spring training game.
Yes.
But I will tell you what, it, you know, two things are always going around during this week. You know, one is March Madness, right? It's just yes. the craziness is getting kicking off and going, and conference battles are being waged, and some sleepers and Cinderellas are maybe winning some conference here and there and sneaking in. So that's huge. And trust us, you know as well as I, Scotty B, that ball players in spring training are paying attention to that. Like every morning they come in, it's like, oh man, did your team win, or their university or college? And then the second thing, in this type of week every year is St. Patty's. And it's just a fun festive celebration. I just came off of being and representing the MLBPAA along with the likes of, you know, Heath Bell, you know, the great Dave Scott. Who else was there that was wonderful? I mean, a bunch of guys, George Gutierrez. Oh man, the horse, Mike Morse. We were in Savannah playing the Savannah Bananas, and Johnny Gomes, your boy, your man, and
my neighbor.
We ended up losing. Yeah, your neighbor. But the bottom line is that I when I flew in last Friday, the first thing I noticed was a bunch of banana stuff, right? I expected that. But I didn't expect a sea of green everywhere in the airport in Savannah. So I'm thinking, wait a second. This isn't, you know, St. Patty's Day weekend. But it turns out that Savannah, Georgia is the second largest celebration of St. Patty's in the nation, in our nation, next to Boston. Of course, you know, the Irish, you know, capital of the United States. And over 400,000 people come in the next week to hang out and celebrate St. Patty's. So it's befitting that we brought up the Reds, you know, many years ago wearing those green uniforms, and that we had Mike Greenwell on the show.
It is all perfectly planned as usual by us. And you had a great time in Savannah, right?
I had a great time. What a great job that was done by, I'm going to tell you something. If you haven't seen a Savannah Bananas live, definitely, you know, pop on. You could, you know, you go on the YouTube page at Savannah Bananas and you could catch that game. In fact, my knee was acting up, so I ended up, you know, Dave Stewart was a manager. I was really more of a bench coach, third base coach. And then halfway through the broadcast or halfway through the game, I jumped up. They asked me to come up into the booth, and I finished off the second half of the game with the young kid that's the play-by-play, and had a blast. You know, had some funny quips and were able to goof off a little bit. But so well represented and such a magical show, especially for the fans that the Savannah Bananas put on, and Jesse, the owner. I was duly impressed. I was expecting more little just silly hijinks. There is a method to their Go Bananas madness, and also my hat tip off to Kate Tayo and the whole crew from, you know, MLBPAA who you know, got us over there, took care of us as always, Scotty, man. They do a great job with our, you know, our alum group of almost 4,000 of us, and they're always sending us different places and representing. And once again, it was a well worth trip. There'll be two more games against the Bananas coming up in April, and then one later on in September. You know, they play I think 90 games. It's like a real Mac Daddy season.
Yeah, that is. It's a hefty season, and there's a lot of choreography going on for each of those
Massive.
Games, too.
The coolest thing was, because when I was a kid, I loved the circus with people on stilts. I'm still to this day, at 60, I'm like dumbfounded at how someone, male or female, can get up on those the real stilts, not the little short, little 3 foot, the big stilts that put you well over 10 feet tall. And do stuff and be, there's a kid they have on their team he was taking batting practice in stilts.
That's insane.
It was like almost like jogging around, and he ended up getting the game-winning, clinching walk-off hit against us. I'll let you know if you didn't watch the game. I'll forget about the teaser. He got a hit on stilts, ran the first because he needed to beat the throw, and he was safe. That was insane, dude. It was a lot. Those guys definitely go bananas.
Yeah, I hope they have a good insurance policy on that guy too. Running around in stilts? You kidding me? I'd be having a heart attack if I was.
It was pure. Almost the best way I could describe it was Vegas entertainment, man. It was at that high of a level.
Yes, right. Cirque du Soleil meets baseball.
There you go.
That's cool. Well, appreciate the bananas and MLBPAA for setting all of that up and entertaining the world. We'll see you next week in the lounge.
The Legends Lounge Podcast is brought to you by Major League Alumni Marketing. Hit us with questions or comments at legendslounge@mlbpaa.com. Check out our memorabilia at mlamauthentics.com. Later, Legends.